Welcome to Practicing Connection, a podcast exploring the personal stories and collective practices that empower us to work together to improve our resilience and readiness in a rapidly changing world. Here to start the conversation are Jessica Beckendorf and Bob Birch.
Hi, and welcome to Practicing Connection. We're so excited to have you with us and to welcome Dr. Bjørn Petersen into the conversation. Bjørn helps social change agents find and sustain clarity, courage, and creativity in his role as consultant, speaker, and facilitator with Looking Bear Leadership. He holds a PhD in community resources and development and has studied communication and group identity and transformational leadership. Bjorn's work intersects with practicing connection in many places. So we're going to embrace the spirit of exploration today and see where our conversation leads us. I had the pleasure of meeting Bjorn at a conference back in 2019. And since then, I have been a follower of Bjorn's work and I have tried to implement some of his work. So let's get started and welcome to the podcast, Bjorn.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
So how do you come to the work that you're doing now?
Well, in some ways, my impulse was to say kicking and screaming because sometimes, you know, the work that we do as somebody who values practicing connections, and I love that that's kind of the framing for this show, for this podcast, is just, you know, it's partly because we're sort of driven to it or dragged to it at times, where the things we find ourselves caring about in the world just sort of necessitate a series of questions and a journey of inquiry and exploration. And so, you know, I think there's the one hand where that's true, but there's also a truth that the work of connecting with people is really caught up in who I am, my whole life story in some ways. There's a way in which it's kicking and screaming, not because it's how I got here only, but because, you know, you sort of you end up where you end up, don't you? And looking back, it's easy to be like, well, this happened and this happened. But there's another part of me that goes, I'm not sure it could have happened another way. And I'm not the fatalist that just sounds like, but there's also a truth to it.
Oh. You know, a colleague of mine and I have wondered, because we've developed some programming together that's all about helping people understand how to build relationships. And one of the things we wondered is, did we partly find this work because we are simultaneously really good at building relationships while we are also simultaneously very bad at building relationships? And anyway, that was something that came to mind, right? With the kicking and screaming image you gave. It's hard. It's the hard way through. Mm-hmm. But it's also the beautiful way through.
Yeah. And you could give kind of that classic biographical answer, and I have that, right? Like, I grew up in spaces where I was kind of taught ways of being together in the world, and everything from like the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, or also like the idea of loving your neighbor as yourself. And I suppose I got pretty fascinated or even obsessed with those questions, like, well, wait, how do you do that? And how do you succeed at loving your neighbor or yourself?
And what if you don't love yourself?
Exactly. Well,
so and then how do you treat your neighbor?
Totally. And what you find is that an awful lot of the answer to loving your neighbor and loving yourself are found in one another. But that is sort of a lifetime of recognition that is constantly unfolding, before me at least. And so you go, man, I think I spent a lot of time trying to understand how to love other people, in some ways because I was driven by it, in other ways because of my own self-loathing and shame and sense of failure as a lover of other people, and let alone lover of myself. And I think I insisted upon the love that other people should get, the justice that other people should see, in part as a way of like self-punishment for all the ways in which I saw myself as a failure in those things. And it wasn't until much later that I started to understand and seek the connection between, as you've talked about on the show in the past, the connection between liberation of self and liberation of collective, and how incredibly intertwined those are. And it fascinates me endlessly. So now in some ways it's kicking and screaming, but it's also just like, how can you look away? And for people who don't think about these things, for me, it's a little bit like, I don't know, living, 100 feet from the Grand Canyon, and everyone's walking around being like, do 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 life and so on. And you're like, should we not talk about the Grand Canyon over here? Because it's large, and it feels like we should talk about it. And so it looms in my life, like this thing that you just, how would you not, how would you live in proximity to connection and personal and social and collective liberation without acknowledging it and exploring it, being interested in it? So it has a gravity to me, that sometimes I'm just, when I'd like to be quite selfish, or like to just, if I'm just exhausted, and I feel a sense of like, I'd rather not deal with the relationships I have to the rest of the world, or the ways in which everyone else is screwed and I'm not, or vice versa. Like I would just sort of like to collapse back into myself, but there's that huge empty space that is so much bigger than me, that echoes every sound I make, every cry, every time I shift in my seat, I can hear this whole other world going, remember me? Remember everything else? And you sort of do just get pulled. That's why I think of it as gravity. You get pulled back to it. And I think that's a really profoundly beautiful thing for me to live in proximity to. Yeah.
One of the things I'm curious about, Bjorn, is, and something that I think about a lot is, if we feel that gravity, and kind of feel called to kind of consider those issues internally and externally, we're doing it within the context of the world, right? Like everything else. And I'm curious about, one of the things that I struggle with is balancing, finding a, well, I don't know if balance is the right word, finding a way to be the way I want to be in the world in the context of my job, my community, et cetera. And I'm curious about your journey, career-wise, and how you've maybe sought out or been able to find ways to, be the way you want to be in the world and do the work that you want to do, in the context of jobs, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that's tough. I think a lot of my, if I look back at, say, the last 20 years, an awful lot of my journey and struggle has been between a world and a job market that continuously values one part of me that I don't hold nearly as valuable as this other part of me. And to varying levels of success, I've tried to integrate the me I want to be, the way I want to be in the world, the things I want to think about and give my time to, with the work that others have found worthy of payment. And there's a real tension there. And I know people who are much better at sort of continuing on a sort of a journey or a struggle where like they found jobs that pay reasonably well, they're salaried and comfortable and so on, and they're able to live within that tension. And I wouldn't put myself squarely against any of that, but there's a restlessness that's inbuilt for me that at the end of the day, and this isn't a superior value system. This is just happens to be the one I apparently keep operating out of, which is I can't really sacrifice very well for very long the part of me that needs to be engaged deeply in questions of connection, of questions of interiority, or of questions of how is what goes on inside us and between us and among us just as important as whatever structural or systematic pieces that we're building. And if I feel in a, you know, career space that I'm too limited, then I tend to jettison. And what that has meant is living probably with far more risk in my life than a lot of people would ever think is advisable. And they wouldn't be wrong. But I also am pretty satisfied. Like, although if you find me on the right day, I'll break down and weep to you about why the world doesn't acknowledge me for my real gifts and why can't I just get paid to do what I want to do and so on. All those things live in me too. I think I've gotten to a point more and more where I'm trying to find those balances. But I think if when I was coming right out of high school, for instance, and some of my earlier work in community building spaces or so on, there was a hope that by the time I was in my 40s that like, then I'll have my own organization, or I'll work in the right place, or like I'll be done with this whole like flitting around working for peanuts kind of thing. To a certain extent, I suppose that's not quite been the path that I've taken. I'm fortunate to have a partner whose vocation and whose sense of calling functions much better in institutions than mine does. And that's a massive privilege. And I do sometimes wonder where I'd be without her. And the answer is probably out in the woods somewhere, having not showered much.
It's kind of interesting that, because I was thinking as we were talking, I was like, recently Wallace Stevens, the American poet, came up in a conversation, and someone pointed out, like, Wallace Stevens is a poet, but he worked his whole life in an insurance company. And I was thinking about that, and thinking that maybe it's, you know, a blessing and a curse to sort of find little ways into the to make the kind of work that we want to do fit into a marketplace, as opposed to maybe Stevens, who was just like, there's insurance company on the left and poetry on the right, and I can just keep a you know, solid line between them, and I don't ever have to drift back and forth between the two worlds.
And I think that's probably where more and more I'm getting to, where I'm at more and more at peace with, right? I think there was a long time where, you know, being academically trained, for instance, I thought maybe the academy, right, universities and colleges would be the place that would host me and I'd find my space. But I was also kind of attached to a romanticized idea of those spaces too, right? Just like we can as an artist or as a anything, you sort of can get to this place where you go, well, you know, they don't probably have to deal with grant deadlines and cranky boards and bureaucracies. And it's like, no, guess what? They do too. But my answer, you know, my answer has been, you know, to be a carpenter, to, you know, do a lot of woodworking, to build fences and decks and drive delivery food, you know, delivery, food delivery. But all of that sort of, I've learned slowly to use those things as material. You know, these are the things that teach me a little bit about life and give me insights. And if I'm awake to them, it really doesn't matter if I'm in a wood paneled office on some university, or in, you know, some field painting lilies in France, or whatever your idealized version of your vocational life. It's really about being awake and being present to where you are that drives this stuff. And that I want to follow by saying that, like, I will take every day of the rest of my life to learn that lesson. And that is why I'm attracted to this idea of practice that this, podcast is built on. It is about practice. And even for me, it's not about a practice in terms of getting better. It's a practice of enlivenment. It's a practice of just living more deeply into today than I otherwise would have, with no guarantee of progress, no guarantee of betterment. Simply, I'm practicing these things because when I don't, life can become unbearable for me for a variety of reasons that are everything from mental, emotional, spiritual, systemic, economic, political, and so on.
Yeah, there's always something that we can be and do better in. And if you can adopt the idea of practice in your life, you're always going to be trying to be and do better. I mean, I know that's a super vague way of saying all the things that you just said, Bjorn, but I think about when I think about connection and relationships and how we think about relationships in a lot of the work that we do in our communities or with clients and all of the different interorganizational, right, coalitions and stuff we might be on. I think that often for a lot of people, relationship is just the thing that happens. When you talk with people. And I think it's certainly a thing that can develop through talking with people. But when you have people who want to think a lot more deeply about how relationships impact their work and how and not just in the transactional way, although I recognize that transactional ways of being are often where relationships start. As you develop trust, they can become more relational and and move on from there. But I think people who are trying to think more deeply about this kind of constantly live in this liminal space. Like we are constantly uncomfortable and constantly navigating. And it's wonderful and it's hard and it's interesting and it's rich and it's hard. I mean, I think you could just keep saying it's hard, it's hard, it's hard.
And also hard.
Yes, and also yes.
Thus the need for practice.
And listening to you, Bjorn, makes me just think about part of the reason it's hard is, like I said earlier, relationships are a way through. And I wasn't clear about that, but really, it can be a way through anything, a way through wicked problems, a way through, even social issues. But the other reason they're also, it can also be very difficult is that it requires a lot of knowing yourself and self-reflection, and it's incredibly difficult. I think it's incredibly difficult to know yourself for some people anyway. Maybe for all people, I don't know, but for myself, I can tell you. I do my
Yeah,
best.
it is difficult, and I think kind of when you let go of that idea, you've probably stopped knowing yourself very well. You're probably living in some kind of delusion because you've started to imagine yourself as a something quite bounded. If we understand and think about how we know and what we can know and how much we can know at any given time, it's quite limited. Our minds are brilliant, beautiful things, but they're not nearly large enough or sophisticated enough to take in all that's going on in the world, let alone even ourselves. And we are such dynamic things, creatures, that if you understood yourself yesterday at noon, by today at noon, you will have changed, if not for no other reason that you somehow knew part of yourself yesterday for a little while. And having done so, you will have changed who you've been. So with that sort of complexity, then, like, I do think you are in a space, we all are in a space where to know oneself is sort of a lifelong journey. It's a lifelong practice, but it's also an endless mystery and can be really delightful if you start to delight in it. I mean, it is hard, right? And it can be punishing, but it can be also so liberating and freeing. And so I think, you know, the tendency is to either, well, we do with knowing the self what we do with so many things, which is we go to the major sociological trends, right? So we commodify it, where we tell people why it will improve their situation economically or politically or so on, or we turn it into a simplistic moralistic fairy tales of good and bad. It's a good thing to know yourself. It's the best thing to know yourself. It's the worst thing to know yourself. You know, we're really quite unsophisticated as a species at the moment at holding things in sort of the tension of, yeah, it's a little bit good, it's a little bad. What do you want? It's all those. Yes, it's all those things. And you can see how the inability to do that, not only in the context of knowing yourself, but in communities in so many different ways, it really disrupts the need to divide and separate and sort out, to know who's on my side and who's not. To sort of look around and be like, are we the ones who like this thing, or are we the ones who don't like this thing? I don't know. Let me check with my people. Let me find out what we're going to say about this. And politically, and from a power position, from a power over position, right, we find benefits in that. But it has a potentially, and I think often in art, and certainly there's endless examples at the moment, when we constantly take every encounter as a thing that will sort us into teams or good and bad and enemies and so on, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. We go, why are we so divided? I don't know. Does our side think we're so divided because of this or because of this? It's like the question of division becomes a new moment to pick a team. And it's not to say that there's not right and wrong. It's not to say that there isn't good and bad. It's not to say any of that, but rather to take notice and again find some self-awareness as collectives, as individuals, and how do we in some ways lazily divide ourselves and sort ourselves into self-perpetuating us versus them relationships. And to your point, when all relationships become us versus them, or most of them at least, of course we put our tail between our legs and run, or we double down, we find our weapon of choice, and we perfect it so that in whatever relationship we're in, we know how to win, we know how to come out of the top, we know how to maintain our power. So you have this, and it's not always that binary. I think we're all capable of each of those things. But you see how relationships can become this hard, scary thing, or this panacea where everything can be solved, because it's the best thing ever.
I see all the time, you know, people refusing to engage in difficult conversations, or refusing to even admit that they have an opinion about something. And when I think about being able to constantly work at knowing yourself, also helps you to know yourself in relation to the people around you. But when you're not willing to share what your thinking is, because either you're afraid they'll think it's wrong or you're afraid that it's wrong, because I believe that we are always learning, and part of learning is being able to talk with each other about what our thinking is currently today, right now, and listening to someone else about what their thinking is currently today, right now. They may not change my mind on anything that I'm currently thinking. They might even solidify based on what they said. I might be like, wow, I don't want to be like that. So I'm going to separate myself, like you said, into this us and them mentality, which is not healthy. But what I'm trying to say here is the refusal to share in a way that is exploratory and learning. And, you know, even if you're not being exploratory when you speak and you're just speaking your mind, but you're, as long as you're doing it in a way where you're also willing to listen to someone else speak their mind, I guess to me, all of this is really tied in tightly to knowing ourselves and to being in relationship with other people. And I just feel like there's a huge, huge disconnect right now. We don't need to talk about politics right now, but there's a huge disconnect. Yeah, let's dig in right now.
Let's do it. We don't talk about politics very much. I mean, not in the straight, you know, the explicit way. You know, we do see that, like you're talking about, Jessica, where people are afraid to express themselves. Well, of course they're afraid to express themselves. They're not in a trusted space. It's not a safe space.
Yeah.
Like I put 30 people in a room and stand up in front of them and say, hey, tell me your opinion on this. You know what I mean? Like, maybe we need relationships and trust and safety there before we do that. And so I don't know where that, I bring up two things and they might not ever intersect, but there's something there, because I think what we're observing in the culture, especially, you know, the online culture, is a lot of all that sharing that is done in safety because of distance, mm-hmm. you know, and then we wonder why people won't express themselves when there's proximity. Well, there's no more safety in the distance like they have online. And we haven't created a safe space with proximity for them to do that.
Oh, that's such a good point. You know, I work in rural communities and I've done a couple projects where I get together some people to have a conversation, to have open, honest conversation. And these conversations are recorded sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I had somebody express to me, and it was just something that didn't occur to me, and I'm so glad that they were willing to share this, because they expressed some vulnerability in telling me about it. But they said, you know, I know of someone who shared their opinion and word got around and they lost their job. And this opinion was not the kind of opinion that should make someone lose their job, but they're in a small community and they spoke against, you know, the wrong issue. And their boss apparently was on the other side of that issue, and it just ended up making them lose their job. So there are serious consequences, and it's not necessarily a safe space when you're in proximity. I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, I think that's really big. And I think when you read my introduction, there's these three words that I've taken a long time to start to put together, which was this idea of clarity, courage, and creativity. And part of the reason I put those three together is because for me, and from my interest and study in social change and social transformation, finding and sustaining those three things in life, both as an individual and as collectives, is vital in order to potentially speak truth into spaces. And so everything you're saying is absolutely fair in terms of how do we make room for dissent? How do we make room for these things? And that a lot of that has to do with the kind of conversations you've had here before on holding space and modeling those things. And in terms of practice, I think there's a lot of little things that I like to do in classrooms or in community settings or so on that help signify to the group what sort of conversation that we're about to have. Because people have a lot of capacities But when they come to a space, they often draw on the well that gets pointed to. And if the well that they start being pointed to is debate, they go to debate, they go to defensiveness, they go to attacks. And likewise, if they see a generosity and a spaciousness, they often can reach into that well too. Both of those things live in the same people. And that's what you can see. We've all seen people who in one space are an absolute lion and in another space seem to be quite meek. And why is that? I think it's because everything we know about psychology and sociology, it comes to bear in terms of what's going on within us, from family systems to traumatic experiences and all these things. But also on a very immediate level, things about the space that we come into suggest to us what we should be prepared for. And many public spaces for civic dialogue and so on are set up in ways that recreate and invoke those established domination and power over focused kinds of power structures and spaces. And so it's not too surprising when we create those spaces, invite people to those spaces, use all the same sort of language and logos and everything else, all the communication symbols that tell people, come here and bring your invulnerabilities, bring your best weapons, because this is going to be a brawl. versus, you know, people from the beginning sort of standing up and saying, I've got an unfully formed thought that I want to just say out loud, and it's going to be a little wrong, and it might even be messy and ugly, but let me say it, and then we'll go from it. And I'm not worried about being right, by the way. I just want to learn. Now, if I frame what I'm about to say in that way, it invites a generosity. It invites, you feel yourself rise with your hospitality to what I'm saying. And now you don't, now, you know, this was a question that came up in another episode where you were asking about how do we hold space with two people where maybe the other person isn't ready to hold space or doesn't know they're ready to hold space. How can I be the only one holding space? Well, if we develop a deep trust in and understand the complexity of the people that we're sitting across, and you can always come up with examples of people who this is just going to be maybe a bit a bridge too far for, but in many people, maybe even most people, I can call out something that lives deep within them from somewhere deep within me, where we invoke a certain kind of space together, and they end up holding me not because they've been trained and because they had that intention 2 weeks ago, but because they are human and something in me and in them recognizes each other, and we rise to a space of mutual holding. Mutuality, I feel, can be invoked by skillful facilitation. That doesn't mean it's foolproof, and some people can just come and decide they're simply not going to participate. And if that's the case, then the question for me becomes, can my heart hold their dissent? Can my heart hold their refusal to participate? Or what's the task for me in encountering that? Because part of what I want to do is learn from that space and increase my own sense of spaciousness, my own sense of what can I be present to. Claudia Rankine, the brilliant poet laureate, I think she said one time, she's an African-American poet, and she used to get picked up and by random people all over the country, and it would be just, you know, somebody's uncle would go to the airport and pick her up and drive her 2 hours to wherever she was going to read a poem, and inevitably they would say something that just would make her go, oh my gosh. And the question she asked herself was, how can I say this so you stay in the car with me? And I find that to be a really useful sort of self-reflective question when I'm in spaces. Not that I don't call wrong wrong. Not that I don't stand up for what's true, but how do I do it in a way that's true to the capacities I have in that moment? And some moments I have the capacity to say, how can I say this so you stay in the car? And sometimes I totally lack that. And it's okay for me to just be like, I'm not going there today. I'm gonna go home. I'm gonna trust the universe will send somebody else to keep you in the car. But it is this balance. And that's, I do think it's a practice.
What you're saying, I think, can be scaled to group settings also. So you started out talking about one-on-one and thinking about your own capacity for what you can handle. But I think you can do the same thing in group settings. And in fact, I think, you know, I know all of us, we've talked about how we are facilitators. And I think a lot of times, a lot of power is given to a facilitator in the room, right? Whether it's given or taken, I guess it depends on the facilitator. But I think that in group settings and in community settings, I think a lot of power is given to a particular person running a meeting when really everyone in the room has a lot more power than they utilize or than they even realize. And so when you're thinking about in a group or team, you could use this for teams too, right? In a team setting, you know, we're all responsible for what's happening in this room. And so, you know, group members can also, you know, start realizing that and holding each other accountable. You know, there might be someone who has dissent, allow them to have dissent. And also, you know, the group members can also hold that person accountable for, you know, any inappropriate disruptions or whatever the issue is. And I think a lot of what you're saying is like the group one-on-one, right? You can be a space holder as a facilitator. You can be a space holder in a group setting or a team setting, but everyone in the room can be a space holder for what's happening and can have responsibility for what's happening.
Yeah. It's, you know, here's the obvious statement of the day. It's more complicated though. Right. If it's the two of us in the car and I'm just trying to keep you in the car, that's so much simpler than
because I'm just going to speed up.
Right. Exactly. when it's multiple people, you know, it's so easy because I've seen it happen before. It's so easy for that to be turned from holding accountable to putting that person out of the car, basically, or
yeah,
saying
you're, right.
You're not welcome in the car. Yeah. So it's definitely tricky.
Yeah, it is. And I think, you know, in an ideal setting, perhaps you have multiple people who feel like they can help set the tone and lead in spaces. And oftentimes, though, you're the only one who you know of is there in that way as the facilitator. But I think I can think of a lot of examples where, as a participant, you know, watching a space go away that I'm going, oh my gosh, I hope this doesn't keep going this way, because this isn't what any of us are hoping that was going to be. This is where, for myself, the idea of courage really does matter. It is not a simple thing or an easy thing to practice vulnerability in a public space. And it's not always a fair thing to expect or ask somebody else to do that, right? And particularly if you're somebody who comes from a background that's not mine, right, where I'm a white heterosexual male, I've got a lot of power and privilege systemically, and so it's easy to imagine that what I can or should do in a space is what everyone should or can do in a space, and that's not always and rarely the case. But as I do think about being in that room where it is lots of different people, I do think about, well, who's where's the, what is the power balance in here? Where are the power centers? And if I choose to use my voice in this space, what am I allowing to happen through me in this space, both systemically? Is it a moment for me to step up and speak as the white heterosexual overeducated male that I am? Or is it a time for me to take a step back? And so there's a constant discernment that is a part of the action side of all this inner knowledge, right? That is always kind of asking and listening carefully. And this is where the presence idea comes in, right? To really be present to sort of what's happening, what keeps unfolding in this space. And to what extent do I reinforce that in what I say, how I say it, when I say it, if I say it, and so on, if I do it. But one thing that I do tend to feel is willingness to risk vulnerability. And I say the word risk, you know, emphatically, because when we are vulnerable, for it to be real vulnerability and not just a practiced emotional manipulation, which more and more I see, but to be real vulnerability, is there's a risk involved, and the risk means I don't have control of how it goes. But part of letting go of that control is itself combating things like white supremacy. It's understanding that that perfectionism and that need to control the outcome and to need to control the space and to be really attached to those things is part of the way that these oppressive systems marinated into me from over the course of my life. And so there's a little bit too of a relaxing into the idea that I'm not going to have a perfect town meeting.
Yeah.
And I don't need to. And actually, a functioning, just loving society doesn't need every meeting to go perfectly. You know, I think sometimes one of the things, especially within a white supremacist mindset, which again, I would say most of us were marinated into if we're living in the US, is when we heard somebody like Dr. King talk about the beloved community, we heard the perfect community rather than what we heard, the community where isms don't happen and there's no injustice and there's no failures of capacity and there's no lapses in judgment or and so on. Rather than what I think it was, is, which is a community with the capacity to deal with all the messiness and failures of life together with 9 billion people on Earth. I mean, we're going to screw it up. We're going to hurt each other. What will it take for us to do to deal with those things in ways where we reduce, if not eliminate, harm and suffering due to injustice, but also hopefully deconstruct and replace systems where generation after generation people are harmed, right? And those capacities are lifetimes of practice, both as individuals and collectives. And so, you know, we try to develop tools and things that will help it, but we also try to develop personal practices and collective practices that call us back into a faithfulness to that sort of vision. And a resilience to those capacities within ourselves.
We're going to pause our conversation with Bjorn Peterson right there for now, but you'll be able to hear the rest of our conversation on the next episode of the Practicing Connection podcast. Thanks so much to Bjorn for participating in the conversation, and thanks to you for listening in today. We'd also like to thank our announcer, Kaylin Goebel, Hannah Hyde, and Terry Meisenbach for their help with marketing, and Nathan Grimm, who composed and performed all the music you hear on the podcast. Thanks again so much for joining us. We hope you'll tune in next time when we'll hear more from Bjorn Peterson. In the meantime, keep practicing.
Practicing Connection podcast is a production of OneOp and is supported by the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Office of Military Family Readiness Policy, U.S. Department of Defense, under award number 2019-48770-30366.